Okay, so I want to basically do a really brief, quick sketch of what can be recognized, at least by our current category of methodological naturalism, as what that would have looked like in the context of the scientific revolution. So to get into that, I'm going to basically trace just a few strands, some theological strands that feed into the scientific revolution. Can't do all of the strands given time constraints. The first one is one that actually flows out of something that Joe has already talked about. That's the idea that sometimes is called ontological homogeneity, coming out of the Christian doctrine of creation. When one thinks about the creator-creature distinction, and what does it mean that all things are created through Christ, as some of the New Testament passages tell us, this distinction was viewed by figures like Irenaeus, Basil, and Philoponus as implying that all of the created order has the same kind of being created. There's the creature, and there is the creator, and that's the only kind of distinction that we have. Philoponus worked out in a more scientific or natural philosophical way that what that means is that everything has the same kind of order. That implies that there's no such thing as a great chain of being, that the heavens are of the same kind of material and operate by the same kinds of principles as everything in the terrestrial realm. The implication then is that there is not only the fact that all of creation has some kind of nature given to it by God, but though the nature is in some sense the same, the order is the same everywhere we look, whether it's terrestrial or the celestial realms. An implication clearly seems to be here that we need to seek to understand creation on its own terms if we want to understand it accurately. Second feature is this idea that God is absolutely free to make whatever kind of creation that he wants. Many, if not most, of the 17th century natural philosophers thought that God had a kind of sovereign freedom over creation. And if God can literally make any kind of creation that he wants, then in some sense we have to actually explore the creation to find out what kind of nature, what kind of order did he give to creation. The upshot then is that empirical study of the creation is something that not only is a valid approach, it seems, or many would have argued in the 17th century, it's our only approach. Particularly if the reasons for why God made creation the way it is remain mysterious or unintelligible or inaccessible to our reasoning abilities. And then a third strand is the two books metaphor. Galileo was one of the most explicit proponents that the book of nature is written in the language of mathematics. That implies that if we're going to read the book of nature, we're going to somehow supply or give an appropriate or accurate interpretation to the book of nature, that we have to be able to get at that language. We have to be able to quantify things. We have to be able to give mathematical expression to nature, to that the kind of order that we're studying. So quantifying natural phenomena is another way of seeing that if we're going to try and understand the created order, we have to take it in its own terms, in this case in mathematical terms. So summing up these and a number of other strands that I haven't been able to mention, for many 17th century natural philosophers, taking created natures on their own terms is what we mean by trying to understand them as accurately as possible. Our methods, our approaches for understanding these natures, the kind of order that creation has, require things like quantification, empirical approaches, and a kind of openness to what the created order is that God has freely given to it. The ultimate goal, if you read almost any natural philosopher in the 17th century, at some point they will tell you that the ultimate goal was to understand the kind of creation that God had made and how God is at work through that creation. They may have varied or differed quite a bit about what they mean by how God is at work in creation. But in some sense, we could have had a bunch of 17th century natural philosophers show up at our meeting and talk and speak to our theme of thinking about how one can glorify God through thinking about science, the application of science for the betterment of humanity, the understanding of creation, and so on. Just a couple of slightly more detailed examples, although I'm going to be brief. Robert Boyle is a very nice example of this kind of approach. A lot of recent scholarship has shown that Boyle not only had a number of theological motivations for his engagement in natural philosophy, that his theological commitments, his theological thinking shaped much of how he approached his natural philosophy. Now, Boyle, like many in the 17th century, believed that God could intervene in the natural course of things. He doesn't want to say that God never does or God is unable to, but he identifies the task of the natural philosopher as studying and understanding creation in its own terms. Here's simply one quote from his work, The Christian Virtuoso. For natural philosophers consult experience both frequently and heedfully, and they are careful to conform their opinions to it, or, if there be just causes, reform their opinions by it. And I've tried to emphasize that that particular phrase about conforming their opinions to it. In other words, if we want to understand the created order, if we want to understand the kind of nature that natural things, the made things of creation have, then the task has to be done in terms of explaining these phenomena, these principles, in terms of natural kinds of processes, natural laws, natural causes, so on and so forth. Now, for Boyle, this has a particular kind of meaning. It means that we attempt to understand the created order as accurately as possible so we can then think theologically as accurately as possible about it. So it's not uncommon to see Boyle give you, two or three paragraphs explaining or working out, in essence, an explanation of something like the behavior of a gas pressure or a chemical reaction in terms of completely natural principles, and then start another paragraph or two where he talks about how this evidences the glory and wisdom of God in creation, how God might be at work in these processes through the laws of nature that govern such processes, and what this means for thinking about God's ultimate purposes for creation. Boyle is also pretty explicit that we don't turn to the scriptures to try to understand the detailed nature of how, say, the laws or various sorts of processes or the qualities, the secondary causes, etc., of creation work. That's the task, the hard task of the natural philosopher by using experiment to be able to understand those things. The ultimate goal, though, again, is that we want to understand the created order as God's creation and what his purposes might be for that, and in particular for Boyle, to have a kind of apologetic approach, evidencing the wisdom of God in creation. Let me say a couple of words about Newton. There's a sense in which Newton is the pinnacle of some of these strands I trace, the mathematization, the quantification of the created order and a kind of mathematical approach to be able to analyze it, and the emphasis on observation or experiment. So I think that one of Newton's greatest contributions to natural philosophy is actually marrying together in a very clear and definite way the empirical and the mathematical in a way that is roughly like what we all expect to see most scientists, at least in the natural sciences, doing nowadays. He used various forms of what we might call thought experiments, basically simplifications or idealizations about realistic situations that he wanted to explore. He develops a mathematical model for that idealization, that kind of simplified picture of reality, works out what the mathematical consequences of that model might be, compares those with the observations of whether they, some of them in some cases might have been his own, but he relies upon the observations of the larger natural philosophy community. So you check and see, how do my mathematical results from my more idealized model work relative to the observations. And then you go back, seeing how much you may be off, and you begin to systematically relax or refine those idealizations and work out what that means mathematically. You improve your model, we might say. Again, calculate what the predictions might be, compare them with the observations, and continue this kind of iterative process. This is actually not very different than Galileo's approach to motion, but Galileo did not have the calculus available to him to be able to work out the kinds of things that Newton was able to work out. So in this kind of fashion, Newton explores a number of forces, and in particular, works out the mathematical form of the gravitational force. And indeed, gravity is one of the prime examples in the Principia of how this kind of approach works out. And Newton basically is proclaiming that he's got a theory of everything. If there's a force out there, this is how you find it. At least to find the mathematical form of the force. It's another question to then identify what the appropriate or actual secondary cause is that matches this mathematical description of the force that you give. Newton's very clear that he wants to make a distinction between providing a mathematical model on the one hand and then asking the question, okay, so ontologically or in terms of the secondary causes, what actual physical cause meets or matches the mathematical description? Why does Newton take these kinds of approaches? Well, partly because he's flowing out of exactly the same sorts of strands that I've sketched, but also in terms of the way he often put things, is he wants to think God's thoughts after him. Right? He wants to understand, again, the nature of God's creation and how it is that God is at work in creation. Newton and Boyle would have had very different understandings of what it means for God to be at work in creation. Boyle is a little bit has a picture of God that's a little bit more distanced. Newton has a much more intimate kind of picture of God's working in creation. But the idea for Newton is to understand as well as possible the secondary causes that God has made, how God works through them, how they play into the kinds of purposes that God has. Now, it is true that the force of gravity is, you know, it's not only a prime example in the Principia, it's also a place where he recognizes that he cannot give you the actual secondary cause that matches the mathematical description. He knows that somehow God makes gravity happen, but he can't give you the mechanism or the law or the force as the language of the day might have given. So he does resist the urge, though, to simply say, well, look, what God does in terms of gravity just works in an unmediated way in creation, and that's that. He holds out for there eventually being a secondary cause that we can eventually pinpoint and say, this is what matches our mathematical description. Unfortunately, he needed a field theory to be able to work that out. He's two centuries too early for that, but that's he couldn't do everything, right? As brilliant and great a thinker as he was. But again, we see somewhat the same emphasis. We try to understand what's the nature of these secondary causes, and then we try to understand how God is at work through them, how they fulfill his purposes. Again, with a very similar idea to what Boyle had in mind, we want to be able to ultimately display the glory of God, his wisdom in creation, and be able to say something about how it is that the handiwork of God reflects something about the wisdom and power of the Creator. So, in wrapping up with a kind of brief conclusion, in the 17th century context, methodological naturalism functions basically as a kind of injunction to understand nature on its own terms that does have the implication, as Joe has already mentioned, that we don't make any direct appeals to God being somehow active in an unmediated way. We're trying to understand what are the means through which God is working to accomplish his purposes. So there is this implication that we don't appeal to God as a kind of unmediated actor in creation. Instead, we want to seek ways, Newton would have said, or Boyle would have said, or even Galileo, I think, would have said, to glorify God by understanding the secondary causes through which he works. And this quote from Lawrence Principe that's actually taken from an essay that's in a book that Ron Numbers is an editor for. Undergirding such scientific activities, the kinds of things that, say, Newton was engaged in, Galileo, Boyle, other natural philosophers, in the early modern period, was the firm conviction that the study of nature is itself an inherently religious activity, even if we're trying to give natural explanations for how natural phenomena behave. Nobody in the 17th century would have thought that there was a cognitive dissonance there. That's one of the differences between our current context, which we're going to be moving into with Ron giving us that transition, and the 17th century and earlier kinds of contexts. The secrets of nature are the secrets of God. By coming to know the natural world, we should, if we observe and understand rightly, come to a better understanding of their creator, which gives us then the ability to praise and worship God, or to be able to fend off the fabled atheist, although the definition of atheism changes sort of from decade to decade. This is a kind of, a prime concern for people. Now, unfortunately, there is an important side effect of all of this focus, right, bringing creation kind of prime and center stage, if you will, for our investigation of it, that flows out of the 17th century emphasis on God's rule in creation through the laws, through the causes, through the kinds of processes that people are studying. So on the one hand, while God's rule through laws really does take center stage, on the other hand, God as Redeemer begins to recede progressively into the shadows, into the background. It's not that if you had, grabbed Boyle by the collar and said, "Don't you believe that God is still Redeemer?" He would have affirmed that. But when you look at his voluminous writings and you look at the other writings of natural philosophers, the idea of God's redemption takes less and less attention. It seeps further and further away as they focus on the sort of the beauty and the order and the understanding of creation. So this shift in emphasis also corresponds to a kind of shift that also has a long history to it, of focusing on God's will, God's wisdom, and God's power in relationship to creation at the expense of God's love for creation. And this is an important strand that plays into the 18th century's conception of God. A perfectly wise creator on the 18th century view is that he would make a creation that requires no divine intervention whatsoever. So once God sets it up, he can just simply watch it actually work. This picture is one that many people have told you, this is the most glorifying and honoring kind of God that you would find. Somebody who can make a creation that doesn't require any other further ongoing upkeep or maintenance or rebuilding it, etc., etc. And if you think about the kinds of machines that we make, they require us all the time to make interventions. So there is a kind of picture of what a perfect creator as a kind of engineer or designer would mean. In the 18th century. The shift also plays into the rise of providential deism in the 18th century, the idea that God so gifted creation that it has everything it needs on its own to fulfill God's purposes without God ever having to, stick his fingers in and do anything again. This begins to drive, well, it's one of the things, it begins to drive a wedge separating out natural philosophy from questions about faith and theology. On the other hand, and at this point, I'll let Ron work through that kind of transition for us.